My name is Susan, and I'm an Al-Anon. And I will tell you, I'm going to introduce them. We've been married for 47 years. Wow. Tell you that when we first came into this program, that I always heard, hold on, you know, put on your seatbelt because it's going to be the ride of your life. And I can honestly say it has really been wild. And the promises do work. And so I'm going to introduce them.
Well, thank you. All right, thank you. Thank you. Yeah, my name is Sims, and I am an alcoholic. And that's right. Yeah, thanks to the program, the promises do come true. There's no question about it. I mean, believe me, I couldn't have stayed married. In fact, I'll tell you this story real quick. You know, when Susan and I got married 47 years ago, I thought, man, I got it made now. I got a gal, good-looking gal, likes to drink liquor like I like to drink liquor. The honeymoon will never cease. And we, you know, we went on our honeymoon down in... Where did we go? The Cloister at Sea Island, a real exclusive place. And we got down there, and we were both so bored because, you know, we ran with kind of a wild crowd, but we hooked up with this other crowd, and we all got drunk, and they all got kicked out except for us. And then we came back to Atlanta to our little honeymoon apartment, and it wasn't 90 days till I discovered that Susan didn't really drink like I drank. It wasn't 90 days till she called the police on me and my buddy, so I knew we were off to a good start. Of course, that didn't stop me from drinking, but, you know, that's just part of married life. But anyway, like I say, I'm an alcoholic, born in Atlanta, 1939, that's a long time ago. Grew up in the 50s, teenager in the 50s, and the 50s were a wonderful time to be teenagers. But I'll even start back. You know, the first thing I think I really remember is my mother in my bedroom. I guess I was in my crib and she was smoking. And there's just something about smoking that appealed to me, even at, you know, 1 year old, one and a half. I don't know why I remember that. You know, other people remember other things. I thought, man, here she comes with that hot cigarette. I thought, damn, that's good. So naturally, I was born an alcoholic. I'm sure I was. Got an older brother. He's 3 years older than me, and another alcoholic tendency I had when we got around six or seven. And we'd fight all the damn time. And of course, I'd start the fights because I was 3 years younger than him. And of course, he'd finish the fights, and we'd tear up the damn house. I mean, just battling everywhere. He'd slam doors on my foot, and, you know, I'd hit him with something. And always, of course, he would win because he's 3 years older. And he'd be on top of me, slapping me, you give up. And I said, yeah, let me up. I give up. But, of course, I never gave up. You know, I always knew that one day we'd be about the same size and we'd finish the thing. And, of course, you know, that kind of thinking kind of goes with alcoholic-type thinking. You know, okay, I'll never do it again if you let me out of jail, you know. But, of course, it doesn't work. I learned that early on. Again, you know, just typical... hyperactive kid, always in trouble. You know, first grade, what's a nice kid like me doing in a place like this? You know, bored, you know. Hey, what's going on? You know, when's recess, you know? Let's get on with the program. And, of course, like always, kind of running with the wrong crowd. I always met the screw-offs, you know. Somehow in school, you know, we just, you know, alcoholic-type personalities kind of stick together. I know we'd be doing the Lord's Prayer. We used to, in grammar school, we used to have to do the Lord's Prayer. So all the kids would be standing there doing the Lord's Prayer with their eyes shut. And I'd be looking around the room, I'd find some other kid like me. I'd give him the finger. Yeah, hell, he'd be busting out laughing. And I'd be, you know, we met a new buddy. You know, now we can go outside and, you know, get in a fight out, in the, you know, or whatever, you know, hyperactive. Alcoholic future type kids do. So, you know, running with the wrong crowd. Went to my first psychiatrist in the seventh grade, you know, find out what was wrong with me. And, well, there wasn't nothing wrong with me. I just, frankly, didn't like school. You know, they discovered my IQ was okay, but you know, I learned a trick in school that I learned how to reverse it finally years later in AA. Because I'd be sitting in the classroom, and the old teacher would just be mouthing something. I couldn't take it. You know, she'd just be talking, and all the other kids looked like they were paying attention.
And I learned I could look out the window and I could think my own thoughts. I didn't have to listen to that. Which, of course, what that did was, temporarily, that felt pretty good. You know, now I can think about girls and playground and guns and stuff I was interested in. But, of course, my schoolwork was terrible. But the only way I got through school was I loved to read. And I guess my IQ was okay, so I could kind of wing it through, at least through grammar school. Got to high school. Sent me to a Christian, at one of Atlanta's first Christian schools, which I couldn't believe. You know, had separate boys and girls, so that was not a good plan. I figured that wasn't going to work too good, which it didn't. And I didn't stay there long. I wanted to go to the regular high school where the girls went. And, you know, Susan was at the high school. We went to high school together. And, you know, hell, I'll tell you another story about Susan. We didn't start dating until after high school, but during high school, occasionally we drank a little liquor together. One time they caught me looking at her paper, and both of us got put out of the class. Yeah, that was a real good plan, you know, just. So kept going to high school. Started drinking up here at Altoona. We had a boat up here at Lake Altoona. Of course, there was nothing more fun for a 14-year-old who was running around with 16, 17-year-olds who had cars to come up here to Altoona. And, of course, back then, Altoona was dirt roads all the way around. It was absolutely nothing. It was a new lake. And I'll never forget, you know, this is a little history of Cherokee County here. They had a little block house made out of concrete block places where anybody could go buy beer. I mean, you'd be driving there. It looked like a little milk jug or something. You'd drive in there with your arm on the side of the car like you're a big guy. Now, give me a six-pack of whatever they had. I forgot the cheapest one or whatever. And, of course, they always did. They always had these little. One place we never went up here, and I'm real glad. That's the reason I'm still here. Is on old 41. They used to have these cut and shoots, which was, I know Claude remembers them. Concrete block place with an air conditioner and a bunch of logging trucks outside. And of course, all they were waiting for was a bunch of high school boys from Atlanta to come on in. You know, that would have been fun. So stayed out of those. Didn't stay out of the Ackworth jail, though. I did go to the Ackworth jail. That was a nice little place. That was kind of like Mayberry. It had a little jail with four cells. Luckily, I got out before breakfast time. I was hoping that the sheriff's wife would bring in breakfast, but I got out before then. But let's see. Next time I went to jail. No, that was the second time I went to jail. First time I went to jail was for running 100 miles an hour out here on 41. I had a super girlfriend. I had a girlfriend who was 16 when I was 14, and she had a brand new car. Oh, it was just so good. I mean, it was so good. So anyway, in her brand new car, by the time I had my learner's license, I was 15. I was driving 100 coming back from the lake, and they pulled me over and took me to the old Marietta jail. I don't know if anybody ever went to the old Marietta jail. Oh, there's another old Marietta jail guy. But the old Marietta jail was on the square. Big old red brick building like you can imagine with the top on the top. And, of course, they told me while I was there that's where the hangings went on. Well, they probably did, to tell you the honest God truth. Marietta was such a redneck. I just got, you know, I hate to bring out a resentment, but Marietta was such a redneck place. I've never seen such a place. I mean, it really was. Especially, you know, the jail wasn't nice. Oh, I'll tell you another quick jail story while I'm thinking about jails. After we were married, after I was a successful businessman and I was about 21 or 22, my father was on the city council in Atlanta, and they opened up the brand new City of Atlanta jail. He was invited, and they all went down there, and he was telling me about how nice it was, and it wasn't a week later that I was in the brand new City of Atlanta jail. But, you know, going to jail was not too big a problem. It was embarrassing, and you know, it brought out all your skills, how to bum a cigarette. You could smoke in jail, that was good. But first time I got a first DUI, I'll tell that story while I'm thinking about it. Four of us were going over to Athens. My older brother by this time was over at the University of Georgia. So four of my buddies, the crowd I shouldn't be running with, of course, popped in my car. And I had a car. You know, my parents told me if I didn't drink or smoke by the time I was 16, they would help me get a car. No chance. I was smoking, I was drinking. I had to get my own car, which, you know, was probably a better deal in the long run, but I had my own car. So we were heading over to Athens for homecoming weekend. Of course, we got a couple of cases of beer before we left. And by the time we hit Auburn, Georgia, this guy in the back seat hollered some profanities out the back window, this toothless guy in Auburn, Georgia, kind of meandering around the street. Got to have, you know, all kind of good stuff came out of the back window. And about 5 miles down the road, the Auburn policeman caught up with us and pulled us over. And, of course, beer cans all over the floor, obviously drunk. Said, that's going to be a DUI. I said, well, I've never had a DUI. I said, DUI. Get in the car with me. And how, somehow, I don't know how this even happened, they let the other guys drive my car and follow them. And we went to the judge's house out in the woods. And the judge said, obviously, you're drunk. $90. I said, whew. I didn't know a DUI was so expensive. But I said, the only other problem is we don't have $90. But as fate would have it, a guy in the back seat had a checking account. So he said, I'll write a check for $90. And so we wrote a bad check for $90. And off we went to Athens. We held beer still in the car. We had a wonderful time. Of course, you know, everybody agreed it wasn't necessarily my fault. At school on Monday morning, we'd all get together to cover the check, come up with $22.50 apiece, you know. So, you know, another good lesson of life. Hey, man, you got to, oh, well, I tried. I couldn't get my money. Well, I tried. You know, nobody could get there $22.50. So finally, I had to go to my mother, which was a humiliating thing, and sort of explain the situation to borrow $90 to cover the check. So DUIs were not as tough back then as they later became. Now, you know, in Atlanta, they were a little tougher than that. They kept going. But anyway, somehow finally got out of high school. Went to three different high schools, naturally, alcoholic-type personality. Went to one, didn't like that one, went to Northside, came out of Northside, sent me up to Darlington and Rome. And, you know, when you send a kid off to high school because he's screwed up, what happens is he meets more screwed up guys from all over the Georgia and all over the South. It's just, you know, it's a great place to, you know, it's like when you go to prison, you meet a lot of people, I'm sure, that, you know, have a lot in common with you, you know. It's, so we had, you know, Darlington, then I came back to Northside. And my grades were terrible because I just really, except for reading and winging tests and getting through, it just was something awful. And again, you know, alcoholic type personality, even when you're not drinking. If I was a senior, if I flunked English, I wasn't going to graduate. I said, man, that's terrible. Well, you know, I got my comic book or I copied somebody else's paper so I could hopefully pass English. And this teacher flunked me, and he flunked this other kid too. He later wound up living at my house. That's the kind of people that I ran with. So we both flunked. We both were not going to graduate. And we came up with this brilliant idea. Why don't we just go whip his ass? You know, what's to lose now? You know, I mean, you know, what can they do? You know, there's what better answer could you come up with? And we kind of knew where he lived, and, you know, plus we thought he was kind of strange. We wanted to whip his ass anyway. But, you know, I didn't know anything about the higher power, but we went, knocked on his door, knock, 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 knock. You know, we're going to either bring him out or go in. And fortunately, he had enough sense not to let us in. He had big old chains and stuff. You know? So that blew over. And as fate would have it, you know, they wanted us in school less than we wanted to be in school. And back in those days, hell, you just get them out of here. Give them some, how much is 3 and 5, 8? Okay, you passed English, you know. So I graduated. And then, of course, the real fun started because I went down to the University of Georgia. And down there, hell, you could drink all day long. You could smoke in class. It was just my kind of place. Now, the only problem was I couldn't go to class. Even with all that, I could smoke in class. I could drink all day long. I just found it impossible pretty much to go to class, playing cards, going back up to the lake, back and forth, you know, having fun, running with the wrong crowd. So I flunked out of there, and actually they do flunk you. Even back then, they flunked you. You know, I should have had so many hours. I got zero. Next time I went, then I went to the Air Force Reserve, thinking that'd straighten me out a little bit. Came back to Dobbins. I was one of the few that never, you know, because of what we did before graduating from basic training, we hid some other kids' gear. They didn't give us a stripe. Me and this other guy didn't get a stripe. But what the hell, I just seemed to have no stripes. It was one stripe, because when I got back to Dobbins, I figured they'd think I was an officer. You know, good IQ, always working on these problems. But anyway, that was a good thing. But then back to the University of Georgia, I'm one of the few people that failed home economics. I thought, for God's sake, I can pass home economics. I couldn't, because I couldn't go. Now, I don't know if I could cook or not. You know, I never found out exactly how good I could cook. But I found that out later. But anyway, and about that time, Susan and I hooked up again after all that. And like I say, she was drinking liquor, I was drinking liquor, we were at the lake drinking liquor, we were having fun everywhere we went, and we got married. It was wonderful. I couldn't believe it. And then I went to work, and actually where I started, my father had a real estate company, and I started in the real estate company, and I learned pretty quick. I was a good learner when I was interested in what I was doing. I learned that if you want to make money, you get around people that are making money, and you do what they do. It's not a complicated situation. The only thing hard is getting around people that are making money to start with. But anyway, I discovered that I could buy a house. I could buy a house for $5,000. I could spend $1,500 fixing it up. I had $6,500 in it. I could rent it for about $70 a month, $80 a month. And I could borrow $7,500 from a savings and loan. I said, hey, what kind of deal is this? Let's get going. So obviously it wasn't long until I had a couple of hundred houses, where I'd borrowed thousands of dollars. In fact, they called me back in the Air Force after I'd borrowed thousands of dollars for the Berlin crisis. That's another, we had a new home in Atlanta. I'd never gotten a registered letter. And all of a sudden this registered letter came to the house. I said, wow, I wonder what that is. I never gotten a registered letter. What is it? Well, you have to go to the post office. So I got in my car and I went to the post office and I got the letter and I opened it. I said, welcome you back in the Air Force for the Berlin crisis. I said, that's the last time I'm picking up a damn registered letter. But luckily the Berlin crisis didn't happen, so everything got back sorted and normal. I went to St. Louis and came back, but I owed so much money at that point. Now, I thought I was going to have to take the Soldiers and Sailors Relief Act. That's what, you owe on a car and they call you back in, you can waive your payments. I thought, well, hell, I owe a couple of hundred grand. I wonder how they're going to feel about me taking the Soldiers and Sailors Relief Act. But anyway, that worked. Like a lot of things, they work out if you just leave them alone. So, in business, love business. Got in the construction business because I had to be in the construction business because we were buying and fixing up all these houses and borrowing more money on them than we paid for them. Pretty soon I had 100, then I had 200, then my net worth said I was worth $1 million by the time I was 23, which, who knows. Georgia Power didn't know. My net worth said I was, my net worth was $1 million. Then soon called, they've cut the power off. I said, God damn. There's a difference in cash and net worth. But you learn there's some few things you do have to pay, like the power bill and the gas bill and the water bill. Other things you can ride. But so I got going with that. And we were doing good. Started having children. We wound up with 5 kids. They were cute. They were cute. They were out of control. Some of them are still out of control, but they were cute. I have a good-looking wife, 5 cute kids, top businessman, young businessman in Atlanta, Yak Yak, going to jail all the time. The answer to drunk driving, one of the answers is get a driver. Ain't that a simple plan? So I had a lot of people that worked for me, so I had... One of my guys drives me around. I come out of a blackout. Where in the hell are we? That was no fun, but that was better than drunk driving. So, by never drinking except on Friday night and Saturday night, getting drunk on Friday night, getting drunk on Saturday night, not touching a drop on Sunday, I could really proceed to be a pretty decent half-assed family guy. I could be a excellent business guy. I could be a upstanding citizen by doing it that way. And it kind of worked. It worked for a lot of years, really. We had a lot of fun. You know, it was fun to be rich when you're young. You know, we had a lot of fun. How we had a house on the most expensive street in Atlanta. We had finally wound up with a yacht in Florida. We wound up with all kind of stuff, all of which were not fun when you're drinking, ultimately, but kind of fun when you know, every night, every other month or so, we go out to Vegas. We had friends in Vegas. You know, we had a good time, really. Except those occasional Friday night drunk, disappeared, screwed up, Saturday night, you know. But kept on going. What else did we do? We just raising kids, you know, typical American dream deal. In 1970, another high school drinking friend of mine and I, and you know, when you're an alcoholic, even though nobody's ever called you an alcoholic, you know you're an alcoholic. Hell, when you're 14, 15, or 16, really, you just know. Hell, my grandfather was at Brawner's getting shock treatments. You know, that's a tip-off right there. My grandparents on the other side, they went through the Depression. They didn't have a dime, but the bootlegger was always there. As a matter of fact, backing up a minute, I liked being a screwed-up kid. I liked being sent to my grandparents because it was a hell of a lot of fun over there. You know, in my house, it was always in trouble, always, you know, are you doing your homework, you know. Over there, my aunt, she was drinking. Hell, she'd get drunk, let me drive the car when I'm 12 years old. My uncle was back from World War II, and he was a hell of a fun guy. Hey, boy, he'd get drunk, and we'd go bowling, and he'd get in a fight with somebody down at the bowling alley. I mean, it was just, you know, compared to where I lived, it was just a fun type thing. It really was. It was wonderful. So they frequently sent me over there where they were on the back porch drinking liquor, laughing and joking, and golly, that's just my kind of crowd. But anyway, we got married. I'll get back to that. Yeah, she called the police at 90 days, so I learned to moderate a little bit, you know, and my friends didn't come over like they used to, you know. Our apartment was not the hangout for the, you know, my friends, so that worked out good. In 1970, I went to my first AA meeting, and again, like I say, a drinking friend of mine, a high school buddy. You know you got the problem when you're 14 or 15, but, you know, you figure, what the hell, if you just don't drink, maybe you'll be okay. Or if you don't drink, and of course, you know, before I even ever heard AA, I tried the beer, drinking only beer, you know, because when I truly would drink, I had probably had 7 or 8 hours range in there, and then I'd be in a damn blackout, and that was no fun. So sometimes at the lake or something like that, or on the boat, you know, we'd start early in the morning. Hell, I'd try to drink beer and kind of, you know, watch it, but that didn't work. Never did work. And of course, you know, your friends say, after you've gone to an AA meeting, you say, man, you think I'm an alcoholic? I say, no, you ain't no alcoholic. Hell no. You know, if you drink 17 drinks instead of 18, you'd be fine, you know. You know. Or maybe, you know, they say, why don't you try drinking with a jigger? Maybe that'd help, you know, because, you know, alcoholic type person, when I'm pouring a drink for you, I like to go, you know, fill you up too. It's a strange thing. So the first AA meeting I ever went to was out at the Biscayne Room, which is in Atlanta. It used to be on New Peachtree Road. Somebody probably remembers the old Biscayne Room. There's the new Biscayne Room now. But I pulled in the parking lot, and it was kind of like one of those cut and shoots. You know, I had a gravel parking lot, a little old concrete block, a little shopping center. And God, you open the front door, and it was so smoky in there, just so thick, you couldn't even get in the damn door. And I felt a little at home when I first got there, you know. I felt like, you know, this is my kind of place, kind of. But I got in there, and of course, I'd come in a brand new Cadillac convertible, and I had a lot of money at that time. And I looked around the room, I saw the people, and the first meeting I ever went to, I could really tell that the AA program worked. You know, I'd seen a lot of stuff. I'd seen business deals. I'd seen all kind of cons. I'd seen all kind of this, that, and the other. But I'd never really seen a clean deal. And to me, when I went to that first AA meeting, this was a clean deal. I could see how it could work. I really could. I could see that AA was something I'd never heard of before. I couldn't imagine, and I couldn't believe that here's a whole room full of people that should have been screwed up in jail, knocked out. They were talking sensibly and making sense, kind of interested in me. I met a guy there that first night. He called me the next day. I never had in my life anybody call me that was genuinely interested in seeing how I was doing. You know, I had a lot of lawyers. I had all kind of flunkies. I had all kind of, but nobody had ever really called me and said, "Hey, man, how you doing?" I said, "I'm doing good." So, and I had a big old black eye. I'd been in a fight down at the Playboy Club. Wasn't much of a fight. You know, when I say I was in a fight, what that means is I said something out of control and somebody whopped me upside the head. And that was, you know, that's the kind of fight I got into. Your fist in my eye got in a fight. But anyway, I had the black eye, and, you know, I looked like I qualified to come on in, which I did. There was no question about it. So I stuck around for about 90 days. I loved it. You know, I'm thinking, what can I do for AA? Maybe I can buy them a color TV. Maybe that's what they need. Well, you know, it was a good thought. You know, I had the one and only requirement for membership, a desire to stop drinking. I didn't want to drink. But again, you know, I got to run in with the wrong crowd. You know, you always find the crowd no matter where you go. Send you off to school, send you in the Air Force, send you to AA, there's the wrong crowd waiting on you. You know, I was young. Hell, I wasn't but 30 years old at that point. And, you know, I found some young guys and girls like me that we like to smoke a little dope in the car before we went to the meeting. You know, we like to adjust it a little bit, you know. But, and dope, smoking dope, to me was just, I didn't like it. That's the problem. That was my problem with it. If I'd have liked it, I probably might still be smoking dope. But, hell, I'd be smoking dope, and I didn't even know how to roll a damn joint, you know. I had to buy a damn cigarette rolling machine, all that stuff. But, you know, and all the damn good stuff would go to the filter because I didn't know how to roll one without it. Hell, I'm smoking them because I had money, so it didn't matter. I'd throw the damn filter away. I probably should have eaten the filter. That probably would have been the good part, but anyway, we'd be in the car smoking dope, and about that time, we started Peachford Hospital, and by that time, I'd say, well, smoking dope, and we fixed up the house. We had lights off, you know, the strobe lights and everything in the house. We were ready for smoking dope, but, you know, it just wasn't my drug of choice. And always when I'd smoke dope, you know, maybe five or six of us sitting around smoking dope and everybody laughing and giggling and, you know, you got your potato chips and all that crap, you know. And the next thing I know, whoa, something's happening to me. Damn, I'm having a damn paranoid attack. I think I might be having a heart attack, you know. And everybody else is just laughing and dancing. And I'm And of course, the only cure for that was to drink a little wine and everybody else was drinking. That cured that problem. So. And I had other problems too. I'll tell you about this problem. When we were little kids, back to my child. I'm bouncing around, I'm sorry. When we were little kids, like all little kids today, you had to go get shots. See? You had to, you know, every spring you had to go get these damn shots. And so they get us in the car. We go into the doctor, and they liked the damn doctor. You know, they had knew his name, they were friends, you know, all that stuff. I'd be in the backseat with my brother. He'd say, "Man, that thing can break off in your arm." I said, "No, no." He said, "Yeah, it happens all the time." He said, "The damn needle will break off in your arm. Then they have to, you know, give you some emergency." I said, "No, it's impossible. It really doesn't hurt." And of course, you know, anytime you take a thought like that and you absorb it, and then here comes a damn doctor with a damn needle, looks like it's about that big, you know. Whoa, the next thing I know, I'm fainting. You know, God damn, there's nothing I hate worse than fainting. That's a horrible thing in case nobody's ever had it. And they, you know, you're on the floor and they, "Oh, you okay? Are you okay? Yeah, I'm okay. Let me up. Is the shot over with? Hell, I hope so." No, he had probably hadn't even had it yet, you know. Only girls faint. I guess everybody knows that, you know. So I'm fainting on the damn floor. And the next thing you know, hell, I've got a damn phobia about naturally shots. But then, you know, later on in life, it develops into things like I could be watching TV and hear a heartbeat or something on TV. I go, God, am I woozy? You know, Jesus, you know, especially with a horrible hangover when that kind of crap starts. You know, you just, and again, you know, trying to put the IQ to the problem. You know, I set off and I bought oxygen thinking that might help the problem. You know, I sent off on Friday. I sent off and bought a damn stethoscope. You know, I could put it in my own ears. I could listen to my own heart. I couldn't do it. I could not do it. It was, you know, because the answer to a phobia is you have to face your fear. You know, if you're afraid of rats, which fortunately I'm not afraid of rats, you have to cook one and eat it. That's how you get over it. That's how you do it. I mean, that's how you get over the phobia. You cook one and eat it, you know. Or, you know, or shots. Of course, fortunately, I never took any hard drugs because I couldn't take the needle. But, you know, hell, I was too old for hard drugs. At least they weren't around when I was around, which I'm glad, because if it had been, that alcoholic-type personality likes anything, you know. You know, crack cocaine. Well, hell, I've never had any crack cocaine. Well, the only reason was they didn't have it. Hell, when they sent us off to school, we'd be grinding up aspirin and smoking it, you know. And nobody's ever tried to ground up aspirin. That's a bad smoke. I don't recommend a ground up aspirin, but I don't recommend crack cocaine, because, you know, but if it had been there, we'd have definitely been on top of it. So anyway, went to the first meeting, and God, I loved AA. I really did. I loved the people in AA. I met Maggie, met all the crowd out there at the Biscayne Room. And again, think, well, I'd like to do something for AA, but AA didn't need anything, because the only thing I had to do for them was money at the time. And, you know, so they opened up Peachford Hospital. It was brand new. And I was kind of part of the crowd. And by that time, I'd gotten into the apartment business. I was building apartments in Atlanta. In fact, I built the Jade East Apartments, which were Atlanta's first singles apartments. This was in 1968. We built 205 units, and we had the clubhouse, and we had the fire pit, and we had the drifters come over, which when the drifters came, about 1,000 other people came, tore up everybody's car, and that was not a good plan. We had the clubhouse where everybody go up there and get in a fight. That was not a good idea. We had the swimming pool where people would jump off the rock wall and miss the pool. We had my maintenance man, who I made the mistake of letting him move in the apartments, you know, so he'd be right there ready to go to work. Well, about the first week he's there, my top maintenance man, he gets drunk, gets beating his wife, pulls out his gun, starts shooting around the damn apartment. And, of course, obviously the police came. I had a friend of mine who lived up above me. You know, bullets go through the floor. You wonder what the hell. But anyway, they carted him off to jail. And then he found out how the hell he got out. To three, that's pretty serious charges. But he came back in a cab. I was there at my office, and he came in. I said, oh, shit. And yet, you know, whenever you're an alcoholic and you know it, and there's another alcoholic, your heart kind of goes out. But the guy had to go. I mean, you know, you shoot up the apartment, you got to go. You know? So, I was going to try and be as nice as I could to him, because he's obviously an alcoholic, too, like I was. And he said, you know, if you dance to the music, you pay the piper. I said, yeah, that's true. And that was the end of the conversation. And somehow he left. That was great. I didn't have to fire him. He just left. But, you know, it opened up Peachford. And what the hell? I couldn't believe it. You know, when you're trying to get sober and you're hanging around AA, the Biscayne Room, I'll go back to the Biscayne Room first. You know, family and friends are trying to help you. So one time, you know, the Biscayne Room used to have a program where you could stay there for 3 days. And, you know, somebody would spend the night with you. On the wall, they had the sticks, the tongue depressors with gauze wrapped around in case you went into, you know, DTs or something. You stick it in your mouth so you don't choke to death. You know, it was a good place. I wish we had a place like that today. Had dye lanterns, and had orange juice and honey, and always had two or three shaking people in a chair, you know, or somebody going into DTs. And it was a hell of a good place. except when you're drinking and you wake up there, come out of a blackout. You say, oh my God, am I in jail? No. Damn, that sounds like an AA meeting going on in that other room. How quick can I get out of this place? Again, AA and drinking are just not fun together. I mean, I would say that. Back to Peaceford. Trying not to drink. Doing everything I knew how not to drink at times. And then sometimes just let it all go. And next thing I know, every time I'd turn around, we had a boat in Florida. We'd be down there, and I'd be drunk, and Susan and the kids would get mad, and they'd fly back to Atlanta, and I'm down on the damn boat by myself. That's no fun. Pier 66, you know, all that fun, yeah, especially for a drunk guy. Went to the first hospital in Florida, you know. They didn't do nothing for me. Gave me some Dilant or something like that. And I said, man, I got to get out of here. Got back to Atlanta. And the next, I don't know what it is about when you're trying not to drink and really trying. Every time you drink, you wind up in the worst possible place you can wind up in. I don't know what it is. Your mother-in-law's house or jail. Mine was the damn hospitals because I despised them. So what happened was I went to every hospital in Atlanta. Peachtree, Peachford, Northside, you know, trying to get treatment, spending money. I didn't have any insurance, and I didn't want insurance, so I just paid and go. Finally, my favorite was Fulton County Detox, because at least they were honest down there. They didn't charge you. You know, and now that, I kind of like Fulton County Detox. You know, be somebody dead out in the hallway, that was a good sign, you know, with a sheet pulled over them. You know, at Peachford, they'd run them off somewhere when they died. So, they come up so that, you know, we could see them too good. So, and you get out of Fulton, you get out of Fulton County Detox, and they give you a bag of vitamins, and they give you some antabuse. Antabuse, give you antabuse. And of course, first thing you do is call a cab, you know, head on out. But, yeah, that happened. Finally got to and when you have money, you think you can figure out a cure. I had a doctor was going to help me, you know. He had a new hospital out here, Windy Hill. Tried that, you know, nothing. Finally went to California. They had the shit treatment center out there in Los Angeles. And I went out there, and what they do at the shit treatment center, it's alcohol aversion therapy, which is a pretty good plan, to tell you the truth. What they do is they give you a shot, kind of like antabuse, which makes you sicker than a dog when you take a drink of liquor. And they take you in this little bar room like place, and they start feeding you liquor. And down one, all of a sudden you're sicker than you ever been. You like, you're throwing it up. Then you down another one, they build you up to 8 drinks. You down another one, you're throwing it up. And then they take you and they give you a shot of pentothal so that you can say, ah, it's my mother. You know. Yeah, hell, of course it was my mother. You know, that's really. But it's the only place I ever went where they did what they said they were going to do, and they did it. It didn't work for me, but, hell, I didn't like the taste of liquor anyway. You know, I didn't drink because I liked the taste. I drank because I liked what it did. Back to Atlanta, back to Peachford, back to Northside. Went to Northside 2 or 3 times. You know, you wake up and come out of a blackout, and you meet your new roommate at Northside. Oh, we're making birdhouses tomorrow. So, oh, shit. God damn. I'm building hotels and apartments and shopping centers, and we're going to be building bird. Yeah, it's great. You know? You go there at Peachtree, you know, some guy would come in off a pass, and he'd have a half pint under his boots, you know. I said, man, how about a drink? I said, shit, by that time I had a lounge at my hotel. Well, you know, plenty of liquor, plenty of good time. I want to be paying $500 or $800 a day to be taking a plug off a half pint in the day room, for God's sake. You know, so that wasn't a good idea. I finally figured at the house I could build my own little treatment facility right there in the house. It'd be cheaper, be easier, be better. So we had I had a big addition to the top of the house, which had cut off a bedroom and had a bedroom and a bath, and I could make that my place, and Susan could keep the door locked, and I just detox right on in there, you know. problem is, you can go out the window. If it had been on the second floor, it might have worked. But, you know. So you keep thinking, you know, finally I was drinking real heavy one day. I said, God damn, I got to have some help. I'm going to go back to Northside. So I got in my car to go to Northside. And I got to the Northside parking lot to pull in. Hell, I was willing to build birdhouses by then. I pulled in the parking lot, and next thing you know, I ran into a damn Mercedes in the parking lot. So naturally, the police came. And when the police came, I went to the North Fulton Jail, which was probably cheaper than going to Northside Hospital, and did the same thing. You can detox pretty well in jail. The only problem, only expensive problem was the Mercedes belonged to a Jewish lawyer. You know, that's always expensive when you tear up his fender, you have to pay for it, which I did. But it wasn't an issue of money at that time. It was trying to get sober. So that worked for a little while, but that didn't work. Finally, the worst thing of all could have happened. I despised Peachford. I really did. I was kind of part of it. I really didn't like it. I came out of a damn blackout in Peachford. This is in June of 1975. There I am in detox one more time. And I said, God damn, I cannot believe it. And by then, I was truly whipped, willing to do whatever it took. And, of course, back in those days, and maybe even today, there was an old guy in the detox with us. And it was kind of informal back then. Everybody helped out, you know. And he was in horrible DTs. I was about in DTs, but I was in better shape than he was because he was older. I was an older guy. And we were strapping him down, trying to, you know, the nurse had come in to give him the shot. And he crapped all in his pants. And we'd strap that crap all over it. And I thought, God damn, I'm paying $300-something a day for this. But then, you know, that was a good thing. It was a real good thing. It was a real good thing. I was in the right place. He finally died, to tell you the truth. He'd been a mayor of a little South Georgia city. I don't know who he was. I only met him in detox. They took him to another hospital and he died. And I thought, you know, that there it is right there. That's, you know, that's the end of alcoholism, death right there, detox. Crapping in your pants, screaming, hollering. So I said, okay, I'm willing. And I was willing. I stayed the damn 28 days at Peachford. Despised it. Stayed there. You know, Dr. Conway Hunter, I don't know if anybody remembers him, had a white suit on. He was a doctor, and he was screwing all the little gals. You know. I was part of the beginnings of Peachford, so I knew him. He'd come around with his clipboard, you know. How are we feeling today? And I'm like, God damn, what do you mean, how are we feeling? You know, hell, you just charged me $8 for a damn aspirin. But I didn't say anything. I just kept my mouth shut. Yes, we're doing fine. You know, yes, we're fine. And everybody thought, oh, Conway, he's so wonderful. You know, I thought, damn, I better get to AA as quick as I'd rather be at a box tied up at the Biscayne Room than to be in this hospital. But I did what I didn't want to do. I stayed the 28 days. And I did have a happy ending, I'll admit. Got out of Peachford, went to the Biscayne Room, started working the darn program. Calls would come in, we'd go do 12-step work. Somebody volunteer, somebody to stay with them, we'd stay with them. And I was at the Biscayne, and of course nobody at the Biscayne Room had a dime. I mean, you know, kind of like a how place, you know, nobody had a dime. This wasn't a wealthy place. And the phone would ring, and this woman said, Conway said I could come back. Can y'all come pick me up and give me a ride back to Peachford? And I thought to myself, God damn, he ought to send a limousine for you. You know, what the hell? Everybody here at the Biscayne Room is broke. We don't have gas money. But I thought, no, that's not right. Hell, we'll work it. I'd learned to keep my mouth shut more than just reacting to, you know, screw Conway. Stayed at the Biscayne Room, went down, got started going to the Dogwood Room, which was in downtown Atlanta. I love the Dogwood Room, to tell you the truth. There we had people that lived under the house, and that was always interesting. We had one, the accountant. This guy had on a 1940 suit and tie, and some old old-fashioned pens in his pocket, and he lived under the house. You know, he'd come to meetings to get a cigarette or something like that. And of course, about that time is when the state hospital turned loose all the nuts on the street, and all the nuts were at the Dogwood, so there's always a discussion, should nuts be in here? Well, of course nuts should be in here. What the hell? You know, we had one guy named Jamie, had on a little policeman's uniform, a little kid, he was a little guy, had a little policeman's uniform on, two cap guns, and he had his cart, you know, his grocery cart with all his belongings in it. He'd come to meeting to get something to eat or something. In fact, we used to have a Sunday morning breakfast down there, and we went down there and we fixed breakfast. And I made the mistake, probably not Susan, taking some silver plate down there. And of course, we had to leave for an hour. Came up, where the hell's the silver plate? You know. But it was a good experience. It really was. I got to the Dogwood room, and like I say, we had a lot of nuts down there. And maybe the meetings were small. There might be 7 or 8 people in a meeting. And about that time, some lady kept talking about her cats in a meeting I was in. Cats did this, cats did that, cats did the other. 20 minutes, I'm looking, God, can't they shut, you know, I wasn't in a discussion. Can't they shut that woman up, for God's sake? Stomach getting all upset, heart hurting, you know. Let's talk about how not to drink liquor. Let's not talk about, you know, I'm thinking this, I'm not saying this. And all of a sudden it hit me. All AA ever said for me to do was not pick up the first drink and come to meetings. They didn't say what kind of meetings to go to. They just said come to meetings. And actually that meeting was better for me than if Bill W. had led it, because I learned a lesson that, all I got to do is just be here. You know, that's my job. And hell, it probably helps that woman talking about her cats. And it don't hurt me. I'm not taking a drink while I'm at this meeting. So this program works. Ain't no question about it. Stayed at the Dogwood, all kind of more situations. Stayed in AA. First sponsor. Well, I'm going to run over just a few minutes. I'll tell you about the first sponsor. You know, when you get into AA, and they tell you, do what the winners suggest. And, of course, the winners always suggest, get a sponsor. I thought, boy, I'd rather be beat with a stick and get a sponsor. But you know, if you're sincere and you're willing to do it, you look around the room and people are talking and you analyze who would be a good sponsor, this, that, and the other. And there was this old guy in there that every time he opened his mouth, he's talking about God. And I said, well, I don't know too much about God. I think I'll ask him to be my sponsor. And I did. He said, yeah, don't you call me if you're drinking. I said, okay. And that was pretty much our discussion. And the next thing I know, and getting to know him a little better, he's a damn religious nut. he's driving his car in traffic. He'll ask God to change the traffic light, or he'll ask God to, you know, open up a parking spot for him. I'm thinking, yeah, that sounds good. You know, that's. And the next thing I know, hell, he's living at my house. He'd lost both his legs, and of course we had a big house and bucket at that time, and had plenty of room for Bob. Bob had one of those cars he kept running into the off the driveway with, but he was a good sponsor. He was a religious nut. I learned that the way I learned is because of or in spite of. You can learn either way. About that time, Susan had started going to Bible study. And boy, when I heard that word, I went, oh my God, just Bible study with some of these nerdy girls we went to high school with. We're going to Bible study, and she bought a new Bible, and she was reading the damn thing, just reading it, underlining crap. But I was, I'd learned in AA enough to know that I was willing to do whatever, when somebody asks you to do something that's sort of reasonable, do it. So they're going to have a party at another friend of ours' house, and they're going to invite, what's his name? Charles Stanley was going to be there. Now, he's a big Baptist preacher. He's on TV still. He's a great preacher. He really is. Yeah. He's a great preacher. So anyway, he was going to be there and his wife. And we get to the party. I'm willing. Maybe I can learn something about God, So we get to the party, and there's Charles Stanley and his wife and all these little people. And they got these name tags on with a wine glass upside down. Now, that pissed me off, frankly. Yeah, I wasn't going to drink. But, I like when other people have the right to drink. I had, I choose not to drink, but you can certainly drink if you want to. I don't want to go to a party where the wine glasses are upside down. But I was there, and we sat down, and Charles Stanley got up to talk, and he had a chalkboard, And all of a sudden he wrote S-O-A-P on the chalkboard. I said, my God, am I seeing things? The son of a bitch is selling Amway. I couldn't believe it. God almighty. You know, and he started to spiel, you know, on Amway and how it works. And, you know, you get people in and you... God, but I learned in AA not to open my mouth. I just sat there. I just, okay. And the next thing I know, because by the way, about that same time, we'd just gone broke. Susan said, well, yeah, that's a good plan. I think I'll sign up. So she went up there and wrote a bad check for $35. And I couldn't believe it. You know, I didn't say anything. You know, he made the spiel and how he felt so good being a pastor of his 5,000-member church, because now when somebody lost their job, he had something to offer them. I thought, yeah, okay. So we got home that night, and there's Susan and our oldest daughter going over the Amway book. I'm thinking, my gosh, holy smoke, something good may come out of this because they're working on it. And the next thing you know, Susan had three customers. She had my mother, who she never would have talked to any other way. She had my aunt, who she had to drive across town to see, who she wouldn't have gone to see without Amway. And she had a friend down the street, so she had three customers. So our gross sales was probably $200. Subtract gas and time, which probably cost us $220. But Amway was a wonderful deal. And I was able to learn another lesson from that to, you know, give my father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. Charles Stanley didn't know what he was doing. He really didn't. You know, preachers aren't supposed to know about business and screwing people and take, you know, they don't know that. I mean, they really don't. That ain't what they teach them in school. So I was able to do that, and I felt better about it. And, of course, today I can watch him on TV. He's a great teacher. He really is. He's a wonderful teacher. He's a wonderful guy, I'm sure. And so Lamway passed maybe a couple of years past then. But anyway, we're kind of drawn to an end. Life is good when you don't drink and you go to meetings. Things work out.